You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Rogue. Each week, we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the roundup, we open up the Brewer's Mailbag to field questions about Zendikar Rising, double face cards, sleeper picks, and the best cards in the set. Then on the Brew Session, new decks with Scourge of the Skyclaves in Modern and Pioneer. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 72 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joining you from Minnesota, and I am joined, as always, by my guy on the left coast, the fiery Northwest, Damon Alexander. Damon, what's going on?
Hey, yeah, I used to say, you know, West Coast, best coast, but right now, that's certainly not the case. Seattle's still pretty smoky, but apparently our neighbors in Portland are really, really struggling, so hope everybody there is managing to stay as healthy as they can be. I mean, I noticed that my throat feels scratchy every so often. I just drink a ton of water and it still doesn't really help. But making it through.
Scary times, very emblematic of 2020.
Yeah, I know.
So a man who's hopefully not having any trouble breathing at all is the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Cave Den Online. Dan Schriever, what is up?
Hey, hey. I'm doing great. I'm a fresh air breather, as they say. How are you guys doing?
Living the dream.
Yeah. Got some new cards coming out.
Yeah, this is the best time of year. So we're recording this Tuesday, but by the time this episode goes live, all of Zendikar Rising will be at our fingertips, both on Magic Arena and on Magic Online. The paper players, of course, they're out of luck, but...
Well, and there's not a lot of paper being played, so.
Yeah, I mean, what paper players? I'm sure there's some people that play paper modern over webcam. I will say I dabbled in some EDH, and they have a huge, huge webcam play scene. It is shocking how well orchestrated their Discord servers are. I think also EDH doesn't map to MTGO play as well as modern and the formats we play, which map, you know, very well to MTGO.
So is EDH like the end goal of Magic? Or is every format that we play just a gateway? All roads lead to EDH?
Yeah, I mean, there's the various subjective feelings we have. You know, I love Modern, I love Canlander, Pioneer's great. But then there's the demographics and the facts. And the facts are that EDH is just this juggernaut. And we are this little piece of, little speck in the sky comparatively. But so far, you know, WotC still supports us and gives us cool new toys and supportive formats. And so... we're good for now, but I'm pretty sure by the time we're, you know, in retirement homes ourselves playing cards, we're not going to be playing Modern, we'll be playing EDH or whatever. Probably EDH.
Yeah, Modern players must be like the planet Earth out there relative to the vastness of the universe. We think we're this shining jewel all alone, the only intelligent life. But yeah, it turns out that the universe is mostly dark matter playing on webcams.
So before we kind of get into the latest and greatest in the Magic world, we'd like to give a shout out to our newest patron. It is Parker E. Welcome, Parker. Just a reminder, you can find our Patreon on patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. There's obviously multiple levels if you're interested in supporting us. That base level gives you access to Discord. There's been all kinds of cool discussions about some of the new cards, some speculative brews around the new Zendikar set. People excited to try out some new ideas. So if you're interested in that kind of discussion, there is lots of that happening on the Faithless Brewing Discord.
Yeah, we also have at the higher tiers some merchandise you can get access to. We have playmats. I am just finalizing the order for our custom tokens, just getting everything lined up right. And they look awesome. They depict the three of us in the style of unglued lands. It's got a very cool frame with our podcast logo kind of in the mana symbol slot. And you get other perks as well. You know, we have mailbag segments from time to time. It's a good way to just get in touch with us. Come hang out and talk brews throughout the week. So patreon.com/faithlessbrewing is where you can sign up if you'd like to join us. We would love to have you there.
Absolutely. So we have a little bit of a kind of a Zendikar mailbag. These are questions from our Discord. some kind of closing thoughts as we spring on the time where speculation ends and we're going to start collecting data here. Let's go through some of these questions. I'll pose the first one. KilgoreTrout503 asks, does Zendikar Rising feel different from the last year and a half of sets? Do you think the power level has been brought back down to a sustainable level where you have to work a bit to figure out how to use a card? I don't see any obvious Uros in the set where everyone changes their colors just to get it in the deck. What do you guys think?
I definitely agree with that feel. I think Ikoria also, besides the companion debacle, Ikoria also felt at kind of a similar power level. There weren't these major Haymaker cards that threw wrenches in every single format we know. Of course, the ones that the companions themselves did all of that and more. But once those got banned, Ikoria itself kind of settled as a fairly, I would say, moderate powered format, certainly compared to Throne of Eldraine and Ikoria. So I certainly hope this is the case. Obviously, it's really difficult to analyze cards. I always make fun of Dan as being the absolute worst, but I confess that it's hard for everybody. And Dan has had a couple really good picks out of the last few sets. He was right about Maze Mind Tome.
Yeah, that's right. The new Sylvan Library. I've seen this sentiment expressed quite a bit that feels like the set has calmed down somehow. We had another question from Brian Madden along similar lines, asking, does this feel like a return to the more normal power level in terms of set design? So I think getting at the same thing that Kilgore Trout was asking. I mean, when you mention Ikoria Daemon, I'm thinking like if it was only off by 10 cards or one mechanic, of which three cards were problematic, maybe it's been fine this whole time. You know, maybe set design has always been fine, but it's just the outlier cards have such an outsized effect on the formats that, or at least the style of play that we prefer, which is competitive one-on-one.
Cue a little picture of all the bannings year by year.
Exactly, right? But that's only a handful of cards compared to each year they design 1,000 cards or more. When they miss, like, you know, we feel like it's the worst year we've ever had in terms of design or something. But take those away. I'm just parroting Aaron Forsyth here. Apart from the outlier cards, everything's just about right. Maybe it always has been.
Well, except for that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? the performances were spectacular, other than my husband being shot in the face. Yeah, I agree. I think this set and Ikoria, they both, I think, share something. They have one new mechanic that is possibly troubling. So I think the companion was obviously troubling. I think when it was spoiled, we weren't telling tales out of school, and we were anticipating how problematic it would be. It had a card ban on power level and vintage, for God's sake. This has another mechanic that is very similar in the sense that it's trying to decrease non-game. So the sort of land spell split card. Now, how powerful that effect is in standard, I think, is actually a very live question. They don't feel powerful in the sense that you brew around them. What they do is they, you know, reduce the floor of, or raise the floor of your deck. So you never have that, you know, bottom 20% experience. And we know that lots of Magic games end in sort of fail states. And if you reduce those enough and you play enough games, then you can actually find ways to win. So these might have long lasting impacts. I don't know if they're quite powerful enough, most of them, to be like altering legacy for years to come. Maybe they will, but I do think that Standard will be dominated by this mechanic in the same way that like 70% of the decks had companions. I forget the number in Standard, and it was quite high in Pioneer and Modern as well. I think that mechanic is very powerful, but it doesn't stick out to you as like, oh, this card is, you know, an Uro or a Teferi or whatever, where it immediately sort of changes the nature of the game. What you have is sort of these death by 1,000 cuts type of power level.
Yeah, I totally agree with David. A card like Uro or Oko makes your deck just play a little bit better every single game you draw it, whereas the split cards between land and spell make your deck just way more consistent in the games that it otherwise would have kind of fallen, you know, with Flutter Screw. And so it's kind of a more sneaky level of power level creep. You know, it's more like a Mystic Sanctuary type card than an Oko.
So it sounds like you're saying of the mechanics in Zendikar Rising, you know, Landfall, we've already seen Landfall. That's fine. We know roughly how it works competitively. Party, I think you guys made compelling cases why we shouldn't be too worried about partying. So it's just the double-faced cards you're talking about that, you know, having the option to play something as a spell or as a land is the one that has you worried a little bit.
Well, and it also kind of gives an easy out if you wish to parrot Aaron Forsyth. You can just be like, oh, well, we kind of underrated how these, you know, land spell splits would work. And, you know, only one of them turned out to be in every deck. But what it means is, like, fundamentally that mechanic is very hard to balance. We saw it with companions. It's very hard to have a companion that did what they wanted to do, so put real deck restrictions on it, but it changed the gameplay in a way that didn't feel actually broken. And it turns out, like, very few of them actually did that. They were either incredibly powerful or like with the Otter, that was so restrictive that you really... Although in Vintage, I guess it was the second best one or third best one. So I'm not actually worried about it per se, because I'm not a Standard player. I do think that these cards will not dominate Standard. Again, the feeling of domination where they cast an Uro over and over again, that's not going to happen. You're just going to feel like, oh man, my opponent just kind of always has it. So it won't feel dominant. It's like when Jace like brainstorms four times. The game is actually over, but there's still like a lot of cardboard to be moved around. You just won't beat your opponent when he or she gets mana flooded or screwed, you know, when you're playing against a control deck or something like that. But I'm not sure that it's problematic in Pioneer and Modern, the two formats that we tend to occupy ourselves with. I think there's a few cards that are kind of interesting and we'll see some play, but I don't know that they'll hold. My expectation, and I'm happy to be proven wrong, is that we'll actually see that they're actually fine.
Yeah, what I find interesting is that WotC decided to release not just like a couple of these cards, like just the Mythic Cycle. There's a bunch of them. And David, you sent us a tweet from Saffron Olive, who brewed up a deck that features no actual, factual, you know, pure land cards. It's all either pure spells or the dual cards. And it's a Standard deck, and the deck would obviously not work as well in Pioneer or Modern. But that deck slightly horrifies me. That, like, that's not what a Magic deck should look like. There should be... This variance from lands and spells is something that we know, we're used to it. It can be very frustrating sometimes. I bust out the Hyper Geometric Calculator in fits of rage and realize, oh, it's only I had 20% chance of this happening. I guess I just built my deck wrong. But we're very used to it. And this really, really attacks that fundamental part of the game. The main saving grace being that I think the cards are not sufficiently high powered to really impact Modern almost at all, and Pioneer perhaps somewhat.
I think one of the things they did, obviously the card files get generated so early, but the one major problem with companions is that each of the cards was actually very powerful. A 5-mana 4/5 that blinks your board is just playable. We've seen people just play it in their deck in Modern and Pioneer. So the free card you were getting was actually like a super high powered card, obviously Lurrus, etc. These cards are all cards you basically would never play. You'd never play a 7-mana sorcery that puts two 4/4 angels into play. You probably wouldn't even play, you know, maybe a 5-mana sorcery these days. That's not good enough. I mean, Broodmate Dragon isn't a card we're talking about as playable in Jund. So I think they did a really good job of making sure that the other side was actually quite weak. So that even when it does its thing in late game, instead of being a land, it's something, it's still, that's not going to feel, the sense of fairness is still going to be preserved, even if these cards are maybe the most powerful cards in Standard.
Yeah, the Mythic Cycle spells are all super overcost, except for maybe the red one, and the other ones all have tap lands associated with it, and the only format where you can really play a lot of tap lands is Standard.
Or Amulet.
Yeah.
So when we were kids, Damon and I used to have a thing that we called Stack, and I've seen variants of this posted over the years. I don't know if it has a specific name, but basically it was just a stack of cards that we kept in a box, and whenever we were between games or between rounds at an event, we pull out the stack. It didn't have any lands in it, and just shuffle it up and, you know, draw a hand of seven. I don't even remember if we divided it into two libraries or not, and just played the game. And the rule was that any card that you drew could be played face down as a land that tapped for any color. So you always had a perfect mix of lands and spells. Do you remember this, Damon?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was a good time.
So over time, you know, I curated the list somewhat to like play more within those restrictions. So there were cards like Quirion, Dryad was in there, so you could bounce. Is it Quirion Ranger? Which is the one that bounces a land to your hand?
Ranger.
Quirion Ranger was in there and the card was just broken, that kind of thing. But one of the takeaways, I guess, it just made every game into this insane value grind fest. Nobody was ever screwed, so it was just like the first person to cast a Muldrifter was just so far ahead. Probe with Kicker was lights out in that format. At least that's how I experienced it. I don't know if that's how you remember it, Damon.
Yeah, I remember it was fun. It was frequently quite swingy with certain overpowered cards. And I'll say one thing is that even if it was fun, you know, we never were like, oh, let's skip this Friday night draft we could go to. Let's just play some Stack instead.
Right. I mean, I think part of the reason was there was no variance in it. Like, the reason that a Muldrifter was so devastating was that the one thing we knew was that every turn, each player is drawing a hit off the top, right? No one's going to brick on their draw step. So if each card is worth another card, you know, the game will just sort of be a back and forth forever, right? So it's kind of like once you remove the possibility of like, oh, maybe they'll just draw lands for a couple turns, it just takes away a big part of like what's exciting about the game. So if it ever did happen that like they determined that these double face cards are such a huge success that we should just do them all the time and let everyone play their cards as lands, like in Duel Masters, which is another Hasbro-owned franchise, I don't think that would be a good thing. I think the variance, we'd miss it, actually.
Yeah, Patrick Chapin talks about this a lot, that the one thing people decide to do when they decide to make their new card game or their new game is they, quote-unquote, fix Magic's problem of land drought and land flood. And what they find is that their game is just worse than Magic. I mean, the variance built into the game leads to replayability, and one of my problems with the fire design is this quest to create non-games creeps very easily into too much power. You have a companion every time. That proved to be way more powerful than Wizards understood it to be. Mystic Sanctuary always draws that same spell again off the top. You have perfect mana as long as you're willing to play Snow Basics. Uro comes back into play over and over again and draws cards and helps you hit your land drops. Once Upon a Time, make sure your opening hand is always the nuts. All these cards, the problem is the same, and it sort of tries to answer the quote-unquote problem with Magic, and I think it ends up making it worse, although not out of... The intent is in the right place, but I think it just misunderstands what makes Magic so great.
Yeah, it's fundamentally tricky, though. I mean, every single format has a different level of kind of consistency in all the decks. A modern deck is way more consistent than a pioneer deck, is way more consistent than a standard deck. And then, standard decks right now are weirdly consistent. Too much fire action going on in them sometimes. But then legacy decks, they have, you know, 4 Brainstorm, 4 Ponder, all the fetch lands and dual lands. Like, they're extremely consistent in what they do. But legacy is still a really good format, Oko aside.
And there are non-blue legacy decks. You're a Maverick player. You don't get to play Brainstorm. You don't get to play Ponder.
Yeah, well, you get to play Green Sun Zenith, which is the green equivalent. And some people play Once Upon a Time, which is also too good for modern.
So we've been going on about these double-faced lands for a little while now, but let's just get right to the heart of it. Let's get into the nitty-gritty. So a question from Ill Sick Nasty asks, when you're building with a new modal spell lands, do you view them as primarily a spell that you can use as a land, or do you view them as a land that you can use as a spell? That is to say, are you shaving lands because these are free includes, or are you building a deck with spells and happy to have 2 or 3 extra lands in your deck? That's the big question, right?
I mean, my first instinct is a lot of times I'm building like a mid-range deck and I want to have like 24 and a half lands. So the first include is almost always free to me because 25 always feels like too much, but I hate worrying about my land drops. So playing a 25th land that does something is already something I'm kind of interested in. I've put sort of lands that do spell-like effects in that slot or like a tri-land that cycles. This would be like the equivalent of that 25th land being a cycling land, although it doesn't fix your mana while coming into play tap. So that's what you're balancing out in a monocolor deck or a 2-color deck. Maybe that's better than a tri-land. I think there are cases, you know, we talked about like that Nia Landfall deck last week where you can maybe shave a land because what you really want is just the raw land drops. If you're playing like 22 land instead of 23 and you're adding, you know, the... a split card, you know, or maybe 2 split cards. You're playing 22 real lands, 2 bad lands, bad in the sense that they come into play tapped, and then like Renin 6 or something. Now you've got like the right mix where your deck is still very threat dense, but you're still committed to making your land drops like through turn 4.
Yeah, I think it's just a very difficult question to answer right now without getting our hands on them and playing with them. My initial reaction would be that suppose we have a hypothetical deck that we decided pre these cards wanted to play 24 lands, 36 spells. The way I would probably start looking at this is to say that, okay, well, I probably would consider converting one spell into a spell land in the sense that this reduces the variance a lot on the mana screw side. You have one extra land. And doesn't actually hurt your spell density either. And on the other hand, like, you could actually go the other direction, but the problem is that the tap lands themselves might mess up your primary game plan. And that's where I'd prefer to swing the variance into reducing screw more than reducing flood.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, unless your deck is specifically focused on, you know, I need to have an untapped land on turn 1 because I'm always wanting to cast, you know, Llanowar Elf, Goblin Guide kind of a thing. That's kind of where I would do it too. And You could maybe consider like two of these to be one land. And again, it depends how useful that spell effect is for your deck. You know, I think Damon highlighted last week the card that, you know, is sort of an expensive murder. That's actually trading for a card. Some of these other ones that are a little more speculative, you know, maybe they aren't always trading for a card. And so they aren't quite worth that extra spell as much. So, you know, it depends on what your deck's trying to do. It depends on what the specific cards we're talking about are. But yeah, my first instinct is to always think about cutting a spell first just to generate that consistency where I'm hitting my first three or four land drops.
Let's throw the card Spikefield Hazard into the mix because we had a specific question about this one from Garden Variety Troll. Spikefield Hazard on the front side is an instant for a single red, deals one damage to any target. If a permanent dealt damage this way would die this turn, exile it instead. The back half is a red tap land. So this is one that we almost talked about last week. It was like on the docket, and then I think at the last minute we were just like, nah, it's not good enough to really get into. But it does have uses, right? It kills X1s, and it can even kill Uro if you happen to catch Uro on the front end. You can Spikefield Hazard, pop it, and then since it died that turn, you will get exiled. But that's a very small effect, right? So maybe you're not going to trade that for a card, and maybe the only way to get your value worth is to play this as a tapped red land. So how would you guys assess this card given the heuristics you just laid out?
Well, and again, it's such a complicated question, even though what you're doing a good job simplifying it. So we have to consider all the structural factors here. One, actually killing X1s, specifically Llanowar Elves, is a relevant thing that most one mana red spells are being asked to do or finish off Teferi or whatever. So it does function basically as shock for the most part in Pioneer specifically, in the way you want it to, against a tier one deck. However, red decks in general, in Pioneer specifically, where this effect is reasonable, don't want any come into play tap lands. They're very tempo oriented because their mid-range plan is bad. So the land part is actually quite poor. If you're pairing it with, you know, like a mid-range like Kiora type of thing like we were doing, the come into play tapped effect is actually really harmful. You can't really treat it like a land, but it is too weak to just be treated as a spell. So there's so much context built into it. It's really hard to say.
Yeah. If this card was one in a red to deal two, I feel like it'd be probably one of the best red cards in the set, possibly one of the best red cards in recent memory. But the effect is just so marginal and the cost of having a tap land is so high that you would really struggle to consider cutting more than a single spell from your red deck. And that would maybe gain you equity in the elves matchups and perhaps lose you equity in other matchups.
It's weird because the example you just gave, Damon, I feel like that would be worse than Spikefield Hazard because I've now learned that I can get that one in a red for two damage and also get a 4/3 after I've done that, like a Bonecrusher Giant. And here you're saying I have to choose between that and a land. This one, at least because it's so efficient, it gives me the possibility of like a really nice turn, you know, where I trade my one card and my one red mana for something. So I feel like it does have like a higher ceiling than the two mana version.
Yeah. Every time that your opponent goes turn one elf and you go turn one Spikefield Hazard, and you have a, you know, enough mounds you can afford to not play it as a land, that game's going to go great for you as a result of that. But there's just a lot of games where you have to play this on turn one instead of playing your one drop or whatever. You can't kind of, it just messes up your curve.
Yeah, and so I guess my takeaway from that is that this is only a defensive card and you really shouldn't even consider it for aggro decks. But I could be wrong about that. Like if you were in an 18 land prowess deck, maybe you're tired of having to mulligan these one landers or no landers. Maybe having this as like your 19th, 20th cheat land lets you keep more hands or something, but every time you draw one, you're like, man, this could have been a Lava Dart class card, and instead it's just a Spikefield Hazard.
Yeah, I mean, I think in Pioneer, again, the context, because it's good against mono black and mono green, the exile effect is very relevant against mono black. It's something against Uro. I mean, I'm not sure that this is the way that you beat Uro, but maybe. But yeah, it goes in a defensive deck, but because red removal is so bad, there really isn't a defensive deck that plays red. There really isn't even a mid-range deck that plays red in Pioneer. So it's just about, it's the right tool for a deck that doesn't exist right now.
Actually, in fact, I claim it's a tool for a deck that does exist right now. And by exist, I'm going to use that loosely. So the Blue Red See the Truth Pioneer list, I think it is at least not a tier one deck, probably not a tier two deck, but it is a collection of Pioneer cards that can win games. And that list runs two shocks. And I can easily see, it also runs four Bonecrusher Giants. And as a result, I can see cutting the two shocks for the two Spike Field Hazards. And then you get to cut a mountain probably. And instead of that mountain, you can play any card you like. I can see that being totally reasonable.
Yeah, so I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing you need to find is that specific context. I don't think you can just talk about these cards in the abstract. I took that deck out and went 1-4 and hated the fact that my red removal couldn't kill anything. But yeah, that's exactly what you're talking about, though, Damon. If that deck is a thing, and whether it is or not is a bit of an open question, then this is the kind of card that goes into it. So it's really hard to answer these questions in the abstract. You have to think specifically about what decks you're trying to attack and what decks this goes into. Like Dan saying, identify your role. Who's the beatdown? I know that this needs to go in a defensive deck. Does a defensive deck that plays red exist? Possibly in Damon's mind, yes. So we have this card that can start to increase our consistency, which did matter. I was missing my land drops in that deck. Sometimes it'd be very frustrating to not be able to play out your thing against other control decks. Obviously, it's great because land drops are awesome against other control decks. So, all right, now we're starting to like solve the riddle for this specific card in a specific format with a specific deck.
Since you've given this nuanced take, let me follow up with my very, very simple heuristic that just tramples over everything you just said. Here's how I think we should be analyzing all of these. First, you have to figure out what is your deck's tolerance for tap lands. If you're playing a deck that just cannot ever bear to play a tap land, like any deck that's trying to curve out would never want to play a tap land, you just shouldn't consider any of these cards. If you're playing a deck that can play tap lands, you know, any kind of reactive deck or mid-range deck, then yeah, these are all worth consideration. But if you're like an aggro deck, you probably just shouldn't consider the ones that come into play tapped. You should consider the mythic ones because they can come into play untapped, and there you should look to replace basic lands with them.
I think that's generally correct, but I'm already imagining scenarios where I think I would consider some of these cards with come into play tap abilities in decks are looking to curve out.
All right.
So for instance, the 200 red instant, sacrifice a creature, do its power to an opponent. I could imagine playing that as like a one of, instead of playing a 23rd land in my sort of red, white aggro pioneer, like hammer time deck. This is like my 23rd land, so I'm not going to flood as much, but it's actually like right on curve. If I play my one mana, 1/1 like goblin warrior on my second turn, I'm able to equip it with my hammer and attack. And then on my third turn, I can actually cast this. You know, it's a worse version of the best version of this spell, but it's all right on curve to actually kill my opponent on turn three. But in the fail case where I don't have my like super aggressive start, it is just another land if I need to get up to play my 4-mana Tahiri, etc.
Yeah, and paradoxically, sometimes I find that the decks that want to curve out with a low mana curve, sometimes can handle the tap lands the most effectively, in the sense that they have a lot of cheap spells so that no matter how many lands they have, they can, you know, double spell or fill the gaps. Whereas a deck like Blue Moon and Modern, for example, your fourth land drop is critical. You have all these cryptic commands that you need to get value out of them on turn four. And then likewise, turn six is when you go Snapcaster cryptic command. And so if those are Spire Both Canals there, you're in a lot of trouble. Whereas a red deck that wants to, you know, set up their fourth land to double spell but on turn five or whatever, they can afford to just play a three drop on turn four or perhaps a one drop and a two drop. So I'm not totally sure about this heuristic, Dan. I think we have a lot to learn here.
Well, I think that maybe you're correctly pointing out that I was wrong to divide it between aggro and midrange, but I think understanding your deck's tolerance for tap lands is something we're used to doing when we're evaluating whether to play fast lands or whether to play triomes or not, or any other kind of utility land. It's just a good thing to know about your deck. It's like knowing your blood type or something, or you're, you know, checking your cholesterol or something.
I don't know my own blood type, so that's why I'm not agreeing with you.
Right. But yeah, it's just good to think through this question first. Like, would I ever consider putting a tap land into my deck? You know, because you can get great effects if you're willing to play tap lands. You can get perfect mana off triomes. You can get scries off temples. You can get creature lands. And if the answer is no, like, because like you're saying, Damon, Blue Moon just can't afford it, then yeah, that's just something you've learned that you can apply also to these double face cards.
I think it's something we will learn quite quickly. This is either like super powerful in a way that we're sort of fearing, or because of the great design of these cards, they didn't make them so powerful that it actually becomes oppressive. And we'll find out quite quickly, like the first standard tournament or whatever is going to expose exactly the way to use these cards. And it's going to be very interesting.
And one kind of really dumb statement, a tap land is much better than no land.
Profound words.
Then you lose your complaint equity. It's easy to say, I only hit my third land. It's the only reason you won. It's like, oh, I played all these goddamn split cards because in certain cases they could be better. And so my tempo was all effed up because I had to play them tapped.
So one final question on this topic was from Craven DeBute, who asked, do we think we will see flip cards growing in numbers with each new set if they prove successful in Zendikar? Actually, Mark Rosewater has already addressed this. I think it's now confirmed that the next two expansions will have flip cards of some kind. Kaldheim will have the rest of the pathway cycle in it. This kind of like tasting the forbidden fruit of design space. What if you could use the backside of the card? Once they've opened that door, I think they're going to keep going back to that well. Now, whether they're going to keep doing it on the land theme, I'm not so sure about that. I think it was said that the cards will be transform cards that are in flavor for the world. So we're going back to Innistrad next year. I'm sure there'll be flip werewolves, that kind of thing. So get used to using checklist cards. And, you know, I think, Damon, you said the era of transparent sleeves has come to a close. But all right, enough about these flip lands. Let's tackle some questions following up on specific cards that we did or did not touch on in our past 2 weeks. So a question from Raptor1551 asks, what are our takes on some of the green-black cards that deal with +1/+1 counters? So think of cards like Swarm Shambler, Grackmaw, Skyclave Ravager, and Oren Reef Ooze. Damon, you just want to tell us about these cards real quick?
Yeah, so as a quick refresher, Swarm Shambler is kind of like a hangerback walker, but not as good. Not to answer the question too early, but one green mana for a 0/0 fungus beast that comes in with a +1/+1 counter. And whenever a creature you control with a +1/+1 counter becomes the target of a spell or ability from your opponent, you get a 1/1 green insect. And then one tap, grow it by a +1/+1 counter. Next up, we have Grackmaw Skyclave Ravager, one green black for a 0/0 Hydra Horror, and ETBs with 3+1/+1 counters. And whenever another creature you control dies, if it had a +1/+1 counter, then you get to put one on Grackmaw. And lastly, when Grackmaw dies, you get an XX black and green Hydra creature token, where X is the number of counters on Grackmaw. Finally, in this entry, we have Oren Reef Ooze, two green for a 2/2. On ETB, you get a +1/+1 counter on target creature you control. And whenever it attacks, you get to put a +1/+1 counter on each attacking creature that has a +1/+1 counter on it.
So any of these grabbing you guys?
I mean, to me, I think the problem is that the +1/+1 counter cards were so powerful already. I don't think any of these cards is even close in Modern. You know, the black-green snake doubles or adds a +1/+1 every time these exchanges happen, and that sees no play. And the deck, you know, with all these cards after the banning of Mox Opal is not very popular. And Ozolith was printed recently, and that's already taking up extra slots. So I just don't think there's any space in that deck. And I think without Walking Ballista in Pioneer, the payoff just isn't there. You can move all these +1/+1s around, but everything's fatal pushable. You're not getting paid off enough for these things. I think they're very interesting for Standard. I think there's enough there to be, you know, the beginnings of maybe an aggro-ish aggressive deck that's taking advantage of these synergies. But the history of these cards is they've really been pushed at various points. And we kind of get to pick, you know, cherry pick the best from each of, you know, 15 or 20 or 30 sets when we talk about these non-rotating formats. And none of these cards quite eclipses options that we had before.
Grackmaw intrigues me in the sense that I feel like the Death Clause is pretty powerful. It just kind of creates a copy of itself, but in more static form. It's just an XX Hydra. It doesn't grow anymore. But, you know, cards like Voice of Resurgence randomly are good in decks that have sack outlets just because you have control over this that stops it from being bounced or exiled or whatever. I suspect that this is just not quite there. It's definitely not as good as Voice of Resurgence, but it does seem like it has a lot of text on it, and it has three heads, and I've learned to respect those types of cards.
Grackmaw made me wonder, like, why I don't like this card, so why don't I like it? I think it's because there are basically two kinds of death triggers. There's the ones that are so good compared to what the card does on the battlefield that you actually actively want to get the death trigger. Like, you want to kill it, and you are rewarded for doing so. The other kind of death trigger is the kind where you actually prefer that the card is in play, but it's just sort of a, okay, well, they killed your creature, but at least you get this bonus, like a consolation prize. And I think Grackmaw falls into the latter camp. Those cards, I think, are not good because you just can't trust that your opponent's going to have to kill your creature. There are so many ways to remove Grekmaw that don't involve giving you the token, you know, whether that's bouncing it or exiling it or anything else, that this card's like that, whose value is tied up in forcing your opponent to actually kill it and specifically destroy it. Those have always been bad.
Yeah, and Drachmaw is just like a little bit too one-dimensional as a beater, and likewise the Hydra is a little bit too one-dimensional. Voice of Resurgence adds a ton of angles to your board in terms of against decks that play Innispeed interaction. The token it spawns can randomly become huge. This card, I do like that it's a legend that is somehow not bad in multiples. You play the second one and you get a 3-3 and you grow the original one, but yeah.
But that's still bad. I mean,
yeah.
If that happens, that's a bad exchange for you.
Trust me, it's better than having two Jewel Rails, Dan.
As for the archetype as a whole, I mean, this is a well they keep going back to. They keep printing more and more +1/+1 counter cards, and yet somehow none of them are cracking constructed, as David said. I actually built a green-white hardened skills deck this week in Pioneer because I wanted to just sort of vet the strategy a little bit and see if there was anything there using Conclave Mentor, and man, it was sad. It was not a good deck. There was no payoff, like David said, especially with Walking Ballista gone. So these cards, I think, don't move the needle for me. It wasn't for lack of options, I'll say that much. There were plenty of cards that dealt with +1/+1 counters. They just weren't good cards.
How about Leyline Tyrant?
Yeah, David, tell us about Leyline Tyrant. So this is also a card that Raptor 5551 had singled out, and I've seen some buzz about this. This is the new Mythic Dragon.
Leyline Tyrant, 2/2 red for a 4/4 dragon, and it has a very unique ability, which is you don't lose unspent red mana as steps and phases end. Then when it dies, you may pay any amount of red. When you do, it deals that much damage, i.e. as much red mana as you have, to any target. The history of 4-mana 4/4 flyers has just not been very impressive. You already had a bunch of 4-mana 4/4 flying options, if you're interested. And you have 3-mana 3/3 flying options as well. So those are both sort of similarly sized for Pioneer. The reason you'd be attracted to this is because you have a bunch of ways to generate red mana, and then some way to trigger this Leyline Tyrant in, you know, a very devastating manner when it dies. I think Dan's point again is relevant, that there's lots of ways to get rid of creatures where it doesn't actually die. Blinking it back to its hand causes, as soon as that next phase ends, all of the mana that you saved up to be gone. You don't get to trigger your dragon at all. The turn it comes into play on turn 4, or whatever, 3 if you accelerate into it, you don't have extra mana floating. So yeah, it's a cool card, but I just don't see a use of it that really makes me want to play this 4-mana 4/4 with no come into play ability functionally.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that this card doesn't double your mana. You know, like I expect it to be like a Gauntlet of Might or something. Given the way these printings have gone, without some extra mana generation, like how often do you have unspent red mana? I mean, you're supposed to spend your mana as the game goes on to keep pace. So I'm not convinced that this is worth it in one-on-one. Now, that said, there are some weird cards, specifically Braid of Fire from Cold Snap adds increasing quantities of red mana during your upkeep. And I think at the time that card was printed, it was like a mana burn problem. It was actually has cumulative upkeep. But now the mana burn is not a thing. Like you just can have all this mana in your upkeep that Leyline Tyrant can sort of harvest and pool up for you. Ironcrag Feat is another way to get a huge amount of red mana, but I just don't see it. I think you'd have to like then work to somehow kill the Leyline Tyrant to get the death trigger. And even then, it's just a fireball. It's not that special.
Yeah, I mean, any format where Elspeth Conquers Death Sees play, I don't see Leyline Tyrant following.
Or 3-mana Teferi, or 4-mana Jace, or, you know, 5-mana Teferi.
Yeah, or Hagra Mauling even.
So how about this question from a Garden Variety Troll? Any thoughts on the new tribal sub-theme improving those tribes in bigger formats? So this is referring to the fact that Zendikar Rising uses the party mechanic, which cares about rogues, clerics, warriors, and wizards. In order to support that mechanic, the set is full of cards with those creature types, and some of them allow you to play like cleric tribal or rogue tribal. We talked about how the warriors tribe now has an equipment sub-theme. The wizards is like a spell sub-theme, and the rogue tribe is like a mill reverse threshold theme. You get a bonus when they have 8 or more cards in their graveyard. Do you feel like any of these individual tribes are now like moving up into more of a tier strategy that you're enticed to play?
You know, I'm kind of interested in rogues, and I think that the warrior equipment theme is maybe going to lead itself to a maybe like tier two, tier three-ish pioneer deck. The rogues are kind of excited. Like I talked about last week, they kind of fit into a playstyle I enjoy where you're playing this sort of tempo flash kind of a thing. Because they are black and blue, you get actually the best interaction in Pioneer. You know, you can still play your Thoughtseize if you want. You can certainly play Fatal Push. You can play some of these blue cards. So I think Rogues for sure is going to be a Pioneer deck. And like I said, maybe the presence or lack of presence of Uro is the one kind of flashing red sign that says if that deck is allowed to exist or not. And then I think that the Warrior sub-theme of equipment, specifically the Hammer Time kind of thing, is something that's going to be explored. I think it maybe just won't get there, but I think it's a deck you'll be able to, you know, 2-3, 3-2 kind of. I think it'll be a deck that wins games of Magic, as Damon was describing the blue-red See the Truth deck.
Can win games. I wouldn't say it's like a deck that wins
is allowed to
games like,
legally.
Yeah. So when it comes to rogues, like, what are the ones that we're seeing here? The ones that catch my eye are basically Soaring Thought Thief and Xerath Sand, the Trickster. I certainly don't see this being modern playable by any stretch, but like maybe Pioneer? Are there any other rogues that you guys are hot on?
There's two more that I would throw in the mix. I would include the new Vampire Nighthawk. I forget the name of it.
Nighthawk Scavenger,
yes. And then I would also play the Merfolk Wind Robber, the 1/1 Flying Rogue, just as another way to enable Xerath Sand. You could also consider the Kitesail Freebooter Human, the 1/2 Ravenous Rat that checks how many creatures are in your party, and then you get to look at that many cards in their hand and make them discard one. So they're all like playable-ish. Now, whether that's enough motivation to fill your deck with rogues is a different question. I think another direction you could easily go is to say, I just want to be a flash deck and play like a Slither Wisp deck like Damon has had some success with.
I think the 2/1 human rogue that triggers on energy, you can pay 2 energy in your upkeep. That card is already very powerful, and I think it's been waiting for a shell to pay it off. And the fact that all these other rogues kind of fit in with it, it's hard to block. It has menace built in already. These rogues often just trigger on attacking. The menace works with the ninja, rogue ninja lord. And I just think in general, like Thoughtseize into that guy is pretty good in these mid-range matchups. It gets around blockers to kill Teferi, etc. So I think that card was just waiting for a shell around it. And all these cards are cards, you know, it's going to just act as like a bad Dark Confidant. You Thoughtseize turn one, you play this turn two, and then you just leave all your mana up to play your flash counter spells and everything else for the rest of the game.
We've played Glintsleeve Siphoner in a few of our decks, and I haven't been super impressed. The card is clearly not terrible, but you play it turn two, you get an energy. Turn three, you attack, and by turn four, you're drawing a card. And
I think the problem, Damon, is you never played it in decks with either Hub.
Exactly.
And I think we can do that now because the blue-black new dual land is printed, so the rest of the mana in our deck is going to be much improved, I think, is my
That's
hope.
That's fair. Yeah, I mean, the effect of these new pathway cards, like, they could really change deck building in Pioneer. Like, untap turn one duels with just sort of no questions asked.
As for the other tribes, I agree with David about warriors and equipment. Wizards, definitely not. I think Wizard Tribal is always going to have this problem where wizards care about spells, but if you care about spells, you're also not a tribal deck. The only exception is Wizards Lightning specifically, just that one card. No wizard in Zendikar Rising changes that paradigm. The Cleric Tribe, I also think no. Cleric Tribal is not really a thing, apart from the fact that Soul Sisters happens to play clerics. In this set, they try to introduce a sacrifice theme mixed with a life gain theme, and it just doesn't really come together. I think the only cleric that you really want to reanimate is Archfiend's Vessel, and we did a whole week on that, and mainly concluded that it's just a sidekick to Lurus, who is not a cleric. So I think Rogues is where I would start looking.
Yeah, and I mean, the one thing to note is these death triggers historically just haven't been that powerful. I mean, they are affected by graveyard hate. You can just kill creatures in other ways, like we were describing. So I just think the Cleric Tribe, not having come into play abilities, none of them do. They all have to die. So you don't just need a cleric. You need a cleric that triggers when a cleric dies. And then you need another piece that allows you to somehow cycle through all your cards. So it's just a lot of moving parts. And especially when you get into these non-rotating formats, the graveyard hate is out of this world. I mean, you got your pick of the litter in terms of stuff, if that actually even became a thing. People are playing graveyard hate to fight real decks. Your deck's just going to get caught in the crossfire.
Question from Haksu. Are there sleepers in the set that are not being widely discussed?
Question presupposes a high level of touch with the discussions on these cards, which I have to say I haven't been following too closely. Dan, have you been reading all these articles about people's constructor set reviews?
Well, we're in the era of the paywall now, so even if I had been reading Star City Games and Channel Fireball, I couldn't tell you without violating the paywall.
The sacred.
And I mean, I say that partly in jest, but also partly, you know, you got to respect the hustle. This is the model for their content creation. I don't want to step on their toes. In terms of my sense of the buzz, like, I think that Omnath Locus Creation is extremely good in Modern, even in Pioneer. So I don't know, like, how widely held that opinion is. I am motivated to, like, write a screed about it and post it on the internet for people to yell at me. That card is giving me strong Niv-Mizzet Reborn vibes. I'll just say that much. So if that is considered a sleeper, I think that's the one that I'm focused on.
I have seen it ranked as like the top 1, 2, or 3 card in the whole set. So
yeah, I've seen that for Standard for sure, which I definitely agree with. I don't know about for Modern. The bar is much higher there, but I think it's good enough to still be the number one card for Modern. David, you had highlighted a card, Forsaken Monument, that we didn't get a chance to talk about. There was also this late-breaking card, Myriad Construct. You want to tell us about those?
Yeah, so what happened was Forsaken Monument, and I'll read through it in a second, but you and I both were just like, this is probably just like maybe a one-of that you'd search up in Eldrazi Tron, and that's kind of where we left it. And I kept thinking about this card, and I was like, man, you know, in the last few sets, we've had these mana doublers, and they've caused a lot of problems. Fires of Invention, Wilderness Reclamation, and Nissa Who Shakes the World. So first Fires was banned, and then once Fires was banned, Wilderness Reclamation had to get banned. Both of those cards see quite a bit of play in Pioneer, as does Nissa. You might say those are like three of the primary archetypes, plus Niv-Mizzet. I mean, that's kind of the deal in Mono Black Aggro. So this has a very similar effect to those that's quote-unquote fixed. So it's a 5-mana artifact. Colorless creatures you control get +2/+2. Whenever you tap a permanent for a colorless, add an additional colorless. So like your Tron lands now, even if you don't have Tron completed, they all tap for 2, for instance. And then whenever you cast a colorless spell, you gain 2 life. So I think in sort of Eldrazi, Tron, and Modern, you can imagine what this card would do. It helps stabilize against aggro. It turns, you know, okay, they disrupt your Tron or whatever. You're still getting this like huge amounts of mana effect. You only have to play 1 in your sideboard because you're playing 4-mana Karn. But this late printed card, like Dan was talking about, I kind of got, you know, sloughed off in the last 10, 20 cards, is Myriad Construct. It's a very strange card. So it's a 4-mana 4/4 artifact creature construct with kicker 3. If it was kicked, it enters the battlefield with a +1/+1 counter on it. For each non-basic land your opponents, if you have more than one, your opponent controls, when it becomes the target of a spell, specifically a spell, sacrifice it and create a number of 1/1 colorless construct artifact creature tokens equal to its power. So it starts as a 4-mana 4/4, and if it gets fatal pushed or whatever, it makes 4/1/1s. That's already just a reasonably good card against mono red. They have to target it to get through. It blocks all their creatures, and you get a bunch more blockers. The kicker is, you know, it can be huge, 10/10, et cetera, for 7 mana still. It doesn't have any evasion, and we know. But the interaction with Forsaken Monument was really fascinating to me because Forsaken Monument both buffs its power, buffs all the tokens' power after, if you can find a way for it to die. And Forsaken Monument generating all the extra mana makes Myriad Construct easy to kick. So I think those two in concert is kind of an interesting sort of mid-range plan, maybe in Pioneer, maybe in Standard, at that kind of... I think it's nowhere close in Modern, but those two interacting is about the level I think that could be appropriate in Pioneer.
So move over, Reality Smasher. We have Myriad Construct in town, who's going to be way bigger, and who needs Trample if you just have a wide board of 1/1s or 3/3s?
Yeah, and so a similar card is like Hangarback Walker. So let's say you want to play some number of Fatal Pushes so you can pop your own construct. Fatal Push also pops Hangarback Walker. Hangarback Walker also pays you off for this extra mana for Forsaken Monument. And if it makes a bunch of Thopters, you know, you don't need that many Thopters off of it where Forsaken Monument is threatening to just kill them out of nowhere. We can also play Karn. Yeah, so I've got a little deck here that we'll have in the show notes that kind of is using those concepts and is trying to sort of, it is a ramp deck, but it's built around sort of uninteractable ramp, which is Ruin in Their Wake, which is a card I've done a lot of experimenting with, and Sylvan Caryatid. So you're not playing any cheap cards for the sort of high class removal in the format to interact with. You're very strong against Fatal Push. It does kill these cards I just listed, but you get paid off for it. But you get to play Fatal Push yourself because you can kind of play a three-color deck where colorless is your third color. And it's kind of easy to do because Aether Hub is functionally tri-land. Llanowar Waste is a tri-land. Fabled Passage helps find your Wastes to help cast Ruin in Their Wake on turn two. So you're basically getting to play Rampant Growth, which is quote-unquote too powerful for Standard.
I'm glad we had this discussion about death triggers already because just seeing this list, it's already illustrating in such a unique way, like the different ways these cards can play out. So Hangarback Walker is an example of a card. It's even more extreme than Voice of Resurgence. Like you really, really want this to die because if you ever pop a big Hangarback Walker and get all these flying Thopters, you're golden, you're set. Whereas the disaster is when you invest a lot of mana into your Hangarback Walker and then they bounce it or path it or something, or Teferi just sends it back to your hand. Myriad Construct, this is not a death trigger, right? It's like what Hangarback Walker wishes it had. Anything that targets this, except Teferi, any spell that targets this will pop it. And that's usually what you actually want in Constructed. You want it to pop because having the bodies spread out just gives you a lot more possibilities than having a single card that can be stopped fairly easily. So the fact that Myriad Construct is like easier to pop, I think is a good thing. And it, you know, it's like a 4/4 for 4 that will probably give you something good. And like David's saying, you can kick it up bigger. You can get the Forsaken Monument down and just go nuts. You can even do some really crazy stuff with, what is that card? Giga Drowse and Ground Rift. Just the way this card is templated, the spell doesn't have to resolve. You can just like target it a bunch of times with the Giga Drowse and get a bunch of servos or whatever they are. So I think this might be a sleeper card, even more so than Forsaken Monument.
Wait, so even if it was already sacrificed for when the first Giga Drowse trigger resolves, it will still trigger each time?
Yeah, I think perhaps because of just economy of words, they didn't give it the sacrifice it and then if you do create tokens. They just said sacrifice it and create tokens.
Oh, I did not catch that.
So all you have to do is put that trigger onto the stack and you'll get the tokens regardless of whether the full thing resolves or not.
Well, I mean, those types of effects are all in Modern, and I do think that we're playing with fire a little bit when we're trying to play this card in that format. So maybe that interaction will never come up, but that's good to know if you have two Fatal Pushes in hand.
Yeah.
Or some Needle.
Well, we'll see if it's templated correctly in MTGO. You can try it once and curse us if it doesn't work.
Okay, last question from the mailbag, just to wrap up our Zendikar preview discussion. What cards are you so excited to brew around that you pre-ordered those cards? Or what cards do you plan on acquiring in some way? Basically, your favorite cards from the set. What do you want to get started on?
Well, that's a different question, Dan. I mean, pre-ordering versus favorite. Pre-ordering is, in general, a thing that I do if you think you have like a good read on an underpriced card.
Mm.
So, for example, Haggard Mauling to me seems like a steal at 70 cents or whatever it's at right now. But on the other hand, like, you know, if you want to get a foil pathway or whatever, I don't know if that's like the best time to buy right now. This generally, it isn't.
Fair point. Yeah, the finance aspect of this is much more complicated. All the prices are probably too high because I think people have not accounted for the fact that every box comes with one of these expedition lands, of which they're all really good. So that already just takes a big chunk of the price of a box is goes towards that box topper card, which is a good thing for people who just like want to acquire playables for their decks.
Oh, so the theory is that a box topper that sells for $50 is included with every box. So a box that would have been $80 is now $30.
Essentially, yeah.
And so you open boxes until the EV of the box is 30 or less, driving the cost of all these cards to basically zero. Oh, I think I saw that theory, but I don't understand it until now.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be as extreme as you said. I think they won't be $50 box toppers, but, you know, $30 box toppers, let's say. So in terms of like pre-ordering, yeah, I'd wait a few weeks. But in terms of excitement, let's focus on the excitement. David, what about you?
I'm super excited for Thwart the Grave. I have gotten fed up with my Blood for Bones list because getting one Agent of Treachery back has not gotten the job done. But two Agent of Treacheries, that's the number, man. Seven squirrels on a branch, like the old song from the sea. We need more Agent of Treachery. So I'm excited to brew on that. I am excited to I obviously brewed up a whole deck already around Forsaken Monument and Myriad Construct. I think that's super cool. I am excited to try a bunch of brews with the sort of quote-unquote bad caster mage, the Seagate Stormcaller. I think that card is actually borderline playable in Modern, and I think it is actually going to be good in Pioneer. I think it's going to be super powerful in Standard. I think the fact that it's not Snapcaster Mage is not a reasonable critique.
I'm kind of surprised to hear that. I certainly don't think that card has a place in Modern.
Well, I have multiple lists brewed for it already.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just excited for a bunch of different cards. We'll have a bunch of them posted in the show notes, obviously. We're looking forward to week in, week out. Some of the really linear things, like try to build a party deck, try to build it'll be fun to play the rogues, but I'm not excited to brew around them. I'm not sure there's that many moving pieces.
Yeah, Badcaster Mage moved up in my mind when I realized that it's actually more mana efficient than Snapcaster for cheap spells like Manamorphos. It doesn't scale to larger spells, of course.
Yeah, it has very, very niche windows in which you're happier to have that than Snapcaster, but I don't know. I guess I'll have to wait and see what you present to us for that card. For me, the card is good. I've already talked about Omnath, but Coveted Prize, the big party payoff, is the one that I am most excited to brew around just because you guys were so adamant that it can't be done or shouldn't be done. And when I hear that, I'm like, this card, it looks so broken if you can do it. And when you tell me I can't do it, I just I have to. Like a moth to a flame, a low IQ moth drawn to the flame. I just can't help it. I got to play that card. So that's where I'm probably going to be focusing my little research and brewing energies on.
I'm excited to see if I can catch people with a Jwari Disruption and the Felidar Retreat.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So actually, we started at the top of this mailbag by saying, how do we feel about the set overall? Did it feel different? Did it feel like a return to normal? I think we all agree that there are no outlier cards multi-format broken, but despite that, individual cards, because they maybe ask more of you, I think, they still have a lot of excitement to them. You can get excited to sort of try to make these cards work for you. So I think it's actually a really deep, rich set, even if not that many of the cards end up cracking the bar of top tier, Modern and Pioneer. So we'll leave it at that for the mailbag. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we are going to get back into some brewing. Stay with us.
Welcome back. Our card of the week to brew around is an exciting new card from Zendikar, Scourge of the Skyclaves. So as a quick refresher, it's one and a black for a demon with a kicker. Let's ignore that for constructed purposes. But fundamentally, it's a star creature with power and toughness equal to 20 minus the highest life total among players. So what does that mean? If your opponent's at 16 and you're at 10, then it's going to be a 4-4 because your opponent is at more life. 20 minus 16 gives us a 4-4. And then as you keep chipping away your opponent, they get them to 12, then it becomes an 8-8. If they go to 8, then you're the highest life total and stays as a 10-10. And so this will be very interesting to figure out as we play this card. Just to dive into a few remarks on the card. So we have tons of experience with Grixis Death Shadow and other Shadow variants. Actually, I've never really played a Shadow deck, but Magic players as a community have. And so we have a pretty good sense of the cards you play and the patterns you take to control your own life total, whether that's being Fetch Shock, Street Wraith, you name it. And the Death Shadow players typically are able to find a life total they're comfortable at as early as turn 3, even turn 2 sometimes to deploy their Shadows. On the other hand, it's pretty easy to control your own life total. Typically, people are only trying to make your life total go down, and so you can just sort of adjust your shocking to suit. But this card requires your opponent to be at a lower life total before you can deploy it. And so unlike Death Shadow, where your opponent's at a healthy 20, but all of a sudden you have a 9-9 in play, this card requires your opponent to be, you have to get some chip damage in to start growing it, and then it grows pretty quickly from there. But the question is, well, what sort of deck can really establish this? It seems to be unlikely that a typical shadow shell is really built to do this sort of operation. The kind of key questions are, well, yeah, does this play out on an early turn, like shadows can come down sometimes, or is this typically a thing that's going to be happening more on turn, four or five? And if that's the case, is this even a good card to begin with? Like, if you're five mana, you could be doing all sorts of broken things. And then secondly, how big does this managing both players' life total thing matter? There's an interesting case here where if your opponent's at 10-10 or less, then the extra size of this card actually is relatively not important because it's going to kill them no matter what. Killing them, dealing 13 damage to a player who's at 7 is really not a big deal. It may as well be 10 damage to players at 10. It's equally putting them to 0 or less. And so to some extent, this card, even though it can get huge, the hugeness is essentially capped in terms of value. On the other hand, the value it's capped at is sufficiently large to one-shot your opponent, which is the only number that really matters as far as a creature's power is concerned.
Yeah, I like the way you're breaking that down, Damon. So given that that's the case, like, where is this better than Death's Shadow? If, let's say, we're just sticking with the shadow heuristic, because I think we know a lot about half of this card. We know how to control our own life total. So is this ever better than Death's Shadow? Or is this just like you might consider it as extra copies of Death's Shadow?
I think there's a very good possibility that it is not better than Death's Shadow ever. I mean, there are obviously mathematical cases where it's better than Death's Shadow, where, for example, you're both at 15 life. Death's Shadow is dead on board, whereas this guy's chilling at 5-5. But in practice, it could be that Death's Shadow is just by far the superior card. Of course, Death's Shadow is not legal in Pioneer, and this card is. And so that may be where this card is able to carve a name for himself, Scourge of the Skyclaves, but only the Pioneer Skyclaves. The modern ones are, the bouncers kick him out of the door. But that's a lesson that we'll have to learn for hopefully ourselves this week.
Yeah, that example of being at 15, I'm trying to think, like, how often does a shadow player feel like, oh, I just wish I could get below 13, but I just can't do it. Can't remember, that almost never happens, feels like.
But it's worth noting, you only have four Death Shadow, so you had the entire amount of your deck built. You know, you had the Jun Shadow, which I think was designed by Josh Utter-Layton. So they were playing, you know, ways to tutor up the shadow. The blue deck is playing all these search things to try to find the shadow. So if you can maybe play less of those cards and more just shadow effects, maybe that is, you know, as a replicative, the rule of eight kind of thing.
Yeah. And if we're both going to have a 5-5 in play, Dan, I can give you 7 reasons why I'd rather be at 15 life than your 8 life. Like, Death Shadow decks are very good at operating on the margin of low life, but it is a real cost. I mean, it makes the burn matchup very tricky. It makes, you know, decks like Humans perhaps, very scary for Shadow decks where they can just get one shot. I've bolt out of Blue Moon tons of times, or just EOT, click, untap, bolt. Shadow decks do get a little vulnerable at very low life totals in a way that Scourge doesn't ask you to be.
Yeah, and I guess if we're thinking in terms of Death Shadow 5 through 8, David, I think you're absolutely right that the reason to go into Jund is, like, we need to make sure we find the shadow. So traverse is one way to do it. And when you're doing traverse for shadow, you're paying double for your shadow. And that's still worth it. The whole premise of that deck is that it's worth it to still get Death Shadow even at twice the price. However, if we are talking about a creature that is always 2 mana, it's almost like not even in the same conversation as Death Shadow. It's like now we're talking about Tarmogoyf or even like Tombstalker. Right? Gurmag Angler is 1 mana, Tombstalker is 2 mana. So if Scourge of the Skyclaves is not on par with those cards, the 2 mana and up cards, I'm not sure that the ceiling is there. So do you think that if we're comparing this head-to-head against like a Tarmogoyf, the Scourge has advantages?
Ironically enough, I think one of its major advantages is that it's not green. So on a lot of these lists I'm going to propose, we're wanting to play red creatures early. And those red creatures are important because they damage our opponent, right? So that gives us the opening to play this early if we like. Against red decks, we've seen all these blue decks bring in some number of Ethergust, often 4. And Ethergust is great against these types of decks because the 2-drop of choice is normally Tarmogoyf. So it's good against their 1-drops, it's good against the 2-drop, the Tarmogoyf, it's good against all the burn you're playing to turn on your 1-mana red drops. Now, all of a sudden, you're punishing them for that. Their Ethergust is not that good. So that narrow interaction is already something I'm interested in. And then I think you pointed out last week, Dan, the sort of combo finish. Some of these types of decks are trying to play Team or Battle Rage style effects. And the interaction specifically with this card, assuming your life total is 10 or whatever, and they're at 15, the first effect does 5. reducing them to 10. Now you're both at 10. When it does damage in the normal phase, it's doing 10. So all of a, you know, you have this replicative effect where all of a sudden you're just, you know, terminating your opponent out of nowhere. So those types of things specifically, which are cards you already were kind of interested in playing, are reasons why this might be worth playing.
Yeah, and I guess if I am being really honest, I'm overselling Tarmogoyf by implying that Tarmogoyf, you know, you don't have to work for Tarmogoyf, because you actually do have to support Tarmogoyf. The reason it's the staple of these black-green decks is that you need to put cards into the graveyard to make Tarmogoyf really shine. So a Thoughtseize into Tarmogoyf is a great start, but just like random one-drop into Tarmogoyf is not a great start, and I think that's one of the reasons you don't really see red-green aggro decks and Modern slamming Tarmogoyf on turn two, because it's going to come down as like a 1-2, and that's just not that good. Whereas if you've built your deck to be like Fetchland, Thoughtseize, Bubble, you can then have an impressive Tarmogoyf on turn two, but Scourge, I think, is leading in a different direction. Like you said, aggressive red decks, so it's a much better follow-up to, like, you know, turn one attacking creature. It demands less of your deck. You don't have to, like, give over spots to just, like, Hand Disruption, for example.
Right, yeah.
So, by my quick calculation, if you take a stock GDS list from Modern, if you have every single land that taps for mana in the deck on the battlefield, then you can pay for this card with Kicker. So the GDS Modern lists probably are not going to be counting on the Kicker cost a total of five black very often. Pioneer lists that have just fundamentally more mana producing lands in the deck with less, no fetches, of course. There's a chance, and it really does set the card up nicely. It's going to become quite huge once that happens.
Yeah, I think for the most part, it should really just be considered flavor text. There may be some sort of, you know, standard usage where you try to like turbo out the thing in sort of a combo-ish fashion, but I think you have to play it for its main rate and be happy with that if you're interested in playing this card in Pioneer or Modern.
Yeah, I agree that we should not be trying to kick this. It's actually quite dangerous to do so. You also lose half your life. The only card that I could think of is a new printing Coral Helm Chronicler. So they seeded a bunch of cards in Zendikar Rising that actually support a Kicker deck. There's an enchantment called Roost of Drakes that lets you make drakes every time you kick something. There's also this card, Coral Helm Chronicler, 2 and a blue for a 2/2. And when it enters, you look at your top 5. You may pick any card that has Kicker on it, put that into your hand. So if you're looking to find something to actually brawl with, this is maybe the biggest card that actually has the Kicker on it, almost as a trinket text, but that makes it eligible to be found off of Coral Helm Chronicler if you're trying to build the Kicker deck. But even then, I would not actually kick this card.
Yeah, the other possibility is that I saw Aspiring Spike 5-0'd recently with a white-black shadow deck, which plays 4 Ranger Captain of Eos to find Death Shadow or various other utility one-drops. So maybe we play Coral Helm Chronicler as our janky Ranger Captain of Eos in Pioneer, where we of course, the miss probability is perhaps uncomfortably high if that's our only payoff.
Yeah, and I guess before we leave this theory crafting segment, we have been mostly talking about Modern, where, as we said, it's trivial to control your life total. If we shift to Pioneer, where new printings are more likely to have, you know, things at a calm or power level, they can make a bigger impact in Pioneer. But a lot of the tools that Death Shadow uses to control its life total are not there in Pioneer, so you almost have to draw up a whole new playbook. Do you feel like Pioneer has the support to easily control your own life total?
I don't know about easily, but the fact that the new land, or I guess spell land, Agadeem's Awakening, is like reasonably playable. You know, you can imagine casting it for X equals 1 or X equals 2. You know, getting to 5 mana is a thing that happens when these games get grindy. It does bolt you. You still get to play Thoughtseize, which is one of the major ways that modern decks control their life total. And you can even play some number, even if you're in a monocolor deck, you can play some number of shock lands just to shock yourself. And then there's just a few other random effects that do hurt you. Spawn of Mayhem, Rankle if it hits your opponent, Murderous Rider when you cast it, activating Castle Lockthwain. Those are all the ones that are coming to the top of my head. So you have ways to do it. You can play the 2 and a red 3/3 creature from the dinosaur that got banned in Standard. So whenever a creature enters play for either player, Eidolon is legal in Pioneer as well, doing 2 damage for cheap spells to each player. So there are cards to do it. I think, that are reasonably accessible in Pioneer.
Yeah, hearing you go through those is making me realize that in Pioneer especially, the fact that you don't have to go below 13 makes a huge difference, right? Because if we're saying the baseline is I want this to come down as 3.3 or 4.4 or something, I can see myself getting down to 16 in Pioneer with the cars you're talking about. I can't see myself getting down to like 10 in the first few turns in Pioneer, not without street wraiths and consistent shock fetches. The great thing about Scourge is losing 4 life is all you need. And if you hit them once or twice, that's going to come down as a sizable brawler who will just get really large quickly. Once he is down, he can fuel himself.
I will say, this seems like a crazy thing to say, this card does not have flying. it looks like it should. The cards that look like they have flying always fool me. it's even like the name suggests it might have flying. The art looks like it has some flying. So you just have to be very conscious. Unless you do something to give it flying, it does not. It
doesn't even have wings. It just has the sort of spinal... ventral? Is that even the right word? flaps or fins.
I don't know. It kind of looks like it's a bat, you know, or like Knight on Bald Mountain kind of
fella. Yeah, that's true. I mean, being a Scourge of the Skyclaves, you would think involves being in the sky. But I know, I can't say I'm an expert of that part of the world.
All right. So all that out of the way, where should we start? Do you want to start in Modern or do you want to start in Pioneer, David?
Well, let's start in Modern because I think it slots into sort of existing decks. I don't think we have to brew too many like new shells. So I have two decks here that have existed in various forms, and I think they're just reasonable homes for the Scourge. So the first one is Red Black Prowess. This was a deck that was super dominant when Lurrus was fully powered, has become one of the better decks. I think there's like 3 or 4 different types of Prowess. There's, you know, blue-red, mono-red, red-black, and red-white. And I think this is just one of the many great prowess decks in the format. And I think Scourge slots in really well. You're already playing your 8-1 drop, so you're starting to do damage to your opponent quite quickly. The mana is a little sketch, so you end up damaging yourself significantly. These decks are already playing Thoughtseize, from what I could tell looking at them. So you have ways where you're removing removal spells from your opponent's hand. Scourge is only a 2-drop, so you still get to keep Lurrus as your companion. And you have the ability to reduce your opponent to 10, you know, almost effortlessly. And this deck can also do a bunch of damage to itself. So your ability to, like, turn Scourge into sort of a one-hit kill is non-trivial.
Yeah, this seems like the most natural home to me. Is there room for an Embercleave in here?
I mean, I am not a prowess expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I have not seen that as a one-of in any of the decks. So I don't know the reason for that. I mean, I do have it in a Pioneer list that we'll take a look at later. So I think it's a card that interacts very positively with Scourge. But the fact that no one else is playing it sort of leads me to believe, let's just start with this. And if it turns out to be really, you know, a sweet payoff, then we can get experimental.
So compared to just the standard red-black prowess builds, prowess, I think, is still the number one deck in Modern, just in the current metagame. Where are you finding the room for the Scourge of the Skyclaves? I notice you still have a bit of Kirrell Keep in this list, so you're actually on 8 2-drops and 8 1-drops.
Yeah, so lots of people were playing multiple Kroxa. That was the easiest cut of my life. I cut down to 1. I think I would much rather just have Cling to Dust. Cling to Dust triggers your Soulscar Mage. It triggers your Monastery Swift Spirit. It is good against Uro, if that comes to be a problem. I think I cut like a Seal of Fire. I don't know, maybe like the 4th Cling to Dust. From shells that I had seen. So I actually think there's a bunch of cards you have to play. I think you have to play 4 Soulscar Mage, you have to play 4 Monastery Swift Spear, you have to play 4 Mishra's Bauble, you know, 4 Lightning Bolt. And then you get into some cards that you know, do you really need to play Seal of Fire? How many do you want to play? Those are cards where I think it's pretty easy to like kind of cut the extra one. You don't need all those cards and exactly the numbers that people are playing. And you can see from the different lists that people are changing around. Some people play no Seal of Fire. Some people are playing 3 Seal of Fire, for instance.
A card that I've seen thrown around in proposed Scourge of the Skyclave builds in Modern is Ikum Hellhound. The color-shifted step links, 1-drop for a red, 0-1 landfall, gets +2/+2 till end of turn. So some people have just added that as an additional 1-drop. Some have suggested replacing Soulscar Mage. Seems a little crazy to me, but are you enticed by that card at all? As just, even though it's not a landfall deck per se, if we've decided that we're, okay, trying to deal damage quickly with red creatures, is Ikum Hellhound worthy of just joining the gang?
I just want to be really, really clear before we get into the specifics of that card. The second best creature in all of Modern is Soulscar Mage. So if you have to cut something from this deck, do not cut Soulscar Mage. Other than Uro, it is the second best creature in all of Modern. So to your specific question about the Hound, I think one toughness has a lot of weaknesses. One, in the mirror, it dies to Lava Dart, which the other 1/2s don't. You don't get to keep that extra land, crack, fetch on your turn. Two, it dies to Renin 6. No card in your deck does. So now you've given yourself, you're setting up Lava Dart as a full-on 2-for-1 that's also maybe adding multiple power to your opponent's board. Prowess, like you said, is the most popular deck. So adding a card that's really weak in the mirror and really weak against Jund, which is not the most popular deck anymore, and it's not that powerful either. But Renin 6 is just a card that people play, and that's a real big loss, I think.
Yeah, I'm convinced. What about, I guess, if you really needed to deal extra damage, you have Goblin Guide, you have Wayward Guide Beast even. You even have Vexing Devil if you're desperate. I think as long as Lava Dart is out there, I don't trust the Akum Hellhound to do that work, especially when Scourge of the Skyclave is really depending on you connecting with a one drop.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if you really need to do damage, I mean, you can play a Lava Spike, right? I mean, it's almost like a permanent giant growth to Scourge of the Skyclaves. You don't even need to play these one drops that are a little conditional damage. The reason that these prowess one drops are so powerful against Soulscar Mage, reducing these creatures to allow you to win combat, but they also, you know, it's 2 damage on turn 2, but it's like 5 damage on turn 5 sometimes. So they scale throughout the game in a way that Goblin Guide or Akum Hellhound do not.
Yeah, so I guess my last question about this deck would be, like, because of the fact that you really would like to connect on turn 1, is it maybe risky to go for a build like Prowess that depends maybe on playing a Soulscar Mage first, and then you open yourself up to what if they Fatal Push your Soulscar Mage or Lightning Bolt it, then you won't even have a turn 2 play because you can't play the Scourge unless they shocked or fetched. Would it not be safer to just play like a Lava Spike version of red, maybe just like traditional burn?
The number of decks that are going to go basic Swamp Fatal Push on turn 1 is just so low, Dan.
Okay. So you're saying you shouldn't be concerned about, you can always play this as a 1-1, let's say, because they're going to do some damage to themselves.
I mean, you also just, you have a density of effects. I mean, they kill a 1-drop. You can play your Abbot of Carol Keep. I've had that played against me many times on 2 with no cards to get. I mean, you have 1,000,000 1 and 0-drop. So it's not like you need to play this on turn 2 or your deck is just doing nothing else. Everything in the deck costs 2 or less. So you've got all kinds of plays that you can make.
Yeah, there is a chance to go turn 1 Murkwater Pathway Fatal Push, I guess.
Those lands are really good. All right, moving on. Tell us about this other variant here.
Yeah, so you guys were talking about sort of the traditional shadow lists, and I think that's right. The shadow lists don't typically play a lot of other one mana creatures. They don't do a lot of damage. They're playing kind of like a faux control until they can get their shadow online, and then they're, you know, trying to kill their opponent shortly. So yeah, you mentioned Aspiring Spike playing a black-white shadow list. We've seen Esper Shadow. We've seen Grixis Shadow. And they aren't playing these prowess creatures. One kind of variant of this deck that does is one that's called Suicide Shadow. And Suicide Shadow, again, kind of gives away the game, and it meets our criteria. It does a lot of damage to itself because it is the 3-color deck. It is playing free ways to damage ourselves and Mutagenic Growth, Dismember. And it was already playing Teemer Battle Rage, which is a card that I think you identified last week as being really powerful with Scourge of the Skyclaves, Dan, for that sort of doubling damage effect. And this is the exact kind of deck where I think I'm excited to not play Tarmogoyf, which gets weaker when we play cards like Become Immense. And I am excited to play Scourge of the Skyclaves, which in exactly the scenario we're outlining, where we're damaging ourselves to 10, our opponents at 14 or something, all of a sudden Scourge just kills them out of nowhere. And it's the only card that can really do that.
So this is harkening back to the Death Shadow Zoo from years ago. Full set of Teemer Battle Rage. So the gambit here is that, okay, before, you know, you wouldn't want to draw Teemer Battle Rage because it only really is lethal with Death Shadow, but now you have 8 creatures between Shadow and Scourge that will probably just kill them with a Teemer Battle Rage if you ever connect.
I mean, you can even get there with your, like, prowess guys. If you have a Become Immense and a Teemer Battle Rage, you know, all of a sudden you're doing 18 damage. I mean,
yeah, that's not trivial. Good and standard back in the day.
Yeah.
The Splinter Twin of Khan standard.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so this is a clean list as long as you're satisfied playing cards like, you know, there's seven straight up pump spells here between Mutagenic Growth and Become Immense, plus four more Teemer Battle Rage. So if you don't have a creature down, you could just be drawing blanks. That said, if you don't have a creature down, you do still have Lurrus waiting in the wings. You've managed to keep everything here under 2 CMC, and there's four baubles here as well to trigger prowess and to make Lurrus a little bit higher ceiling.
Yeah, and one possibility is that Scourge, to some extent, compares to Tarmogoyf, which is a 2 CMC beater. And perhaps it's good to have a kind of like a 2-2 split, for example, if we find ourselves with too many turn 2 Skyclave cards that don't do anything or just die immediately, I guess I should say.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously, you could even try it as a, you know, one of you could play the 3 Tarmogoyf. You could play it as the 5th Tarmogoyf. You know, maybe 4 was not the right number of this effect in the first place. You want to cut down some of these pump spells, maybe like Dan's describing. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways you can do it. You know, this is my kind of instinct to start just to see straight up, is Scourge, you know, a card that's threatening? Is it a card that's doing something unique, you know, with the sort of Teemer Battle Rage interaction? Maybe Teemer Battle Rage is so good with it, you don't really need as many Become Immenses anymore, for instance. That's certainly possible.
Yeah, I could see that. And I guess this is the deck in which Scourge of the Skyclaves is definitely auditioning directly against Tarmogoyf. You know, Tarmogoyf has the tools to be supported here. There's baubles here for artifacts. There's Thoughtseize. There's Fetchlands. You can make an impressive Tarmogoyf in this shell. So if we don't like the way Scourge is performing, it's just a question. Whenever we draw one in the leaves, we can sort of ask, would this have been better, the Tarmogoyf?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so those shells make sense to me in Modern. They use a lot of the tools we've come to expect. Both of them are Lurrus decks, so they're actually not using Street Wraith. But I think, as we learned from the Lurrus era, that's fine. Death Shadow can do just fine with that. How about in Pioneer, where we don't have these same easy tools to control our own life total?
Yeah, so the first shell I'm interested in is just Mono Black Aggro. This is a deck that's existed for a long time. It's the deck that got the Looter Scooter banned. It was already playing, you know, one drop, two drop, already playing Thoughtseize, which is a card that damages ourselves. It's a card that was already playing Murderous Rider. It was already playing some number of Spawn of Mayhem and Rankle Master of Pranks. All these cards damage ourselves a little bit. Because it's mono black, we can just slot in. I'm slotting in for Agadeem's Awakening, so we have a way to bolt ourselves right in the face if we need to get an early Scourge in play. Also, the interaction that Damon's pointed out with Blood... Knight of the Ebon Legion. You can sort of like start on a Bloodsoaked Champion. On turn two, you can attack your opponent for two. Thoughtseize them and then play Agadeem's Awakening, bolt yourself, you know, play a Knight of the Ebon Legion. And Knight actually sees that you did 5 damage to yourself. So you played as a 2-3. So you've got a lot of outs to do that. And then you have Castle Lockthwain, which is a card that really lets you control your life in the mid game. All of a sudden you can, you know, do 2 damage to yourself. Or 3 or whatever with your castle. It's good, obviously, to grind, but it also helps make your Scourge of the Skyclave super threatening.
So now we're really getting into the thick of it, because once we're looking for cards in Mono Black that support the general Mono Black aggro strategy while incidentally costing you life, there's a bunch of cards that are like almost there. And then every time you promote one and say, okay, this is going to be main deckable, let's do it, there's trade-offs. Like the Agadeem's Awakening seems like a perfect fit, but then your Castle Lockthwain's get a little bit iffy, right? There's only 9 swamps now, I guess 10 with Urborg. So maybe we have to trim Castle Lockthwain to just get our swamp count higher.
Well, these black pain lands I have listed can easily be shock lands. So you can just play, you know, black red shock land or whatever. I mean, it still counts as a swamp is the important thing.
Mm. I mean, I think they should be pain lands. I think the black desert, if near deadlands, is good enough that I'd actually like to have that in my Scourge deck. So yeah, it basically means you're giving up Castle Lockthwain to do that. But I think that's okay, because the Agadeem's Awakening is like a castable card for 5 mana, certainly. So you're mitigating Flood that way.
Yeah, well, funny enough, if the cards you're getting back are, you know, Dread Wanderer or Scrappy's Grounder, it's kind of pointless.
Well, you get back your Scourge of the Skyclaves. I mean, what could be bigger than that? All right, how about other cards that pay life? There are some interesting ways to do it if you dip into white, and the white-black mana is pretty good. So can I interest you at all in like Odonto Vanguard, Orzhov Charm, or even like Final Payment?
Yeah, I think Odonto Vanguard is a very good card in this type of shell. And I do think it is better than Scrap Heap Scrounger. So you just need to decide, like, do I not want to play Mutavault And do I not want to play Castle Lothwain? And in exchange, I can play specifically that card. Those other ones are a little iffier. I don't know that I'd play them over Fatal Push, even with the life synergy. But yeah, maybe you'd fit one of them in or something. So the real issue is not the white card, which I think is actually quite powerful. It's the lack of other white cards. Just splashing for just that, I guess it's not technically a 3-1, maybe doesn't seem worth it, because I do think Lothwain and Mutavault are very powerful cards as well.
But white has all these great cards in Pioneer, right? We had a whole episode on this.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. White is just generally weak, and in general, they've really toned down any of the sort of aggro effects you might get out of white, so.
I think Orzhov Charm is, like, an okay card. I played a full playset during Archfiend week. I think I saw Aspiring Spike had two in his modern list, the one that Damon was referencing, that white-black shadow one. So it's not a horrendous card.
Yeah, I think that card, you know, is worth maybe a slot or two, possibly. So you're talking about splashing white just for six cards, and you are missing out on Mutavault and Lothwain.
Yeah.
It might be worth it. It might not. The Aghanim's Awakening gets a lot worse because, you know, if your whole deck isn't just asking for black, then it's not always even casting your spell on time. But you probably still have enough black sources. It's possible. It's possible. I mean, that card is a lot better than Scrap Heap Scrounger, I think. So, especially once you have the synergies with Scourge of the Skycliffs. So, that's not nothing.
So, the other thing that worries me a little bit is, what if I lose the die roll with this deck? And then I play my one drop on my first turn. And then on turn two, they play like a blocker, Sylvan Curated or something. And now I just can't damage them. So being mono black, I don't have access to just like I don't know, what is the Lava Spike equivalent in Pioneer? There really isn't one, but it's actually hard to damage them without the combat step. And most of your cards are 2-1s.
My experience is that every single Pioneer player, you know, pre-game, they'd very, you know, my deck's so good, I'm playing so well today, I'm going to get super pumped up. There's this little thought, well, what if I lose the die roll, though? Like, I don't think it's specific to this deck.
Fair enough. But you understand my general concern is, like, if we're talking about controlling their life total, Mono Black doesn't have a lot of tools for that, apart from just attacking with ground creatures.
No, yeah, other than attacking. And I guess, technically, Spawn of Mayhem and Rankle both have ways. I mean, Rankle has to hit them, but Spawn of Mayhem does it for you every upkeep.
Okay, well, I mean, I think this is a well-known, successful core of cards, so I think putting Skyclave into a deck like this will let us sort of see the ripple effects that trying to accommodate it has on a mono-black archetype. So it's a good place to start. What about this list that splashes red?
Yeah, so the problem is they chose, in the infinite wisdom of WotC design, to not print the red, black, what's the new cycle being called?
Pathway.
Yeah, so our mana is terrible in red, black, unfortunately. And
white, black mana is better than ever.
Yes, sadly. So Rakdos, poor Rakdos, just doesn't get the love it deserves. At the same time, red adds cards that are very interesting. So Embercleave is one I'm interested in. I think Damon mentioned it as a modern powerful card, possibly. I have Rotting Regisaur and Goblin Rabblemaster as cards that are just naturally powerful with Embercleave. Embercleave obviously has interactions with Scourge of the Skyclaves. I think we just talked about him. And then there's a bunch of other cards here that are sort of interest. Goblin Rabblemaster obviously just is a high power card. Demonic Embrace is a card that if it is discarded or goes to your graveyard, it's a way to control your own life. It's a way to give flying to this Scourge of Skyclaves that was fooling me earlier. And it's just a way to give flying to, you know, a Goblin Rabblemaster or Rotting Regisaur. I mean, those are huge threats by themselves. In your two-drop slot, I'm playing four Glintsleaf Siphoner. So one of the ways we can kind of minimize our mana requirements is to play four Ether Hub as sort of a faux dual land. And, you know, you can just win games off of, like, Thoughtseize into turn two Glintsleaf Siphoner. You know, you can grind a little bit until you kind of set up your quote-unquote combo, whether it be Scourge of the Skyclaves in Embercleave or Rotting Regisaur or Goblin Rabblemaster and Embercleave.
How close are we to playing a playset of Citrus Supplier in this deck? I mean, with the Demonic Embrace, is actually a pretty good way on the Citrus Supplier. You lose some life. You have a 4-2 flyer, so your opponent loses some life. It sets you up for now. You milled over Scourge of the Skyclave. You cast Aghanim's Awakening. You get him back. And it's kind of Christmas land, but this is what Citrus Supplier is built to do.
Oh, interesting. So you're talking about how Demonic Embrace costs you 3 life when you cast it from the graveyard, but not when you cast it from the hand.
Right. Demonic Embrace is much better from the graveyard than hand, I think.
Well, they cost the same amount of mana, and they both require a card.
Yeah.
But actually, here you want to lose the 3 life, potentially. So that's interesting. I don't think I see enough synergies without, like, lots of Kroxas, which I think this deck isn't going to have room for.
Sinter Supplier, to me, is just a card that you always imagine these sweet things, and it, like, mills two land and a Knight of the Ebon Legion. You're like, well, I played a 1-mana 1/1 that was basically textless, and I cannot win this game now.
But people win tournaments with that card. I have the exact same result. I can play Hogak.
Other people do. Against me, yeah, absolutely. But unfortunately for everyone, you don't always get to play against me. Sometimes you have to just, like, play against a normal person, and then your Sinter Supplier doesn't just, like, read one black mana and win the game.
All right, so let's talk about the lands. You pointed out that the mana is terrible. What about Mana Confluence? So this is a card that, you know, has always been the last resort land for Pioneer when you really...
Oh, I wasn't even thinking of that. Yeah, just cut the Foreboding Ruins and probably one other card and play 3 Mana Confluence. That's
just 3, though? You wouldn't go to the full playset?
No, you can't do that. You have to play against other aggro decks, too. Like,
well, the more they hit you, the bigger your Scourge gets, and then you just Embercleave them out.
Yeah, and then they just go to your face with some stomps, and you're just like, man.
Yeah, and they're still at 18 life, so you actually have a 2-2.
I was kind of persuaded by that 4 Teemer Battle Rage list from Modern. I mean, Teemer Battle Rage is also in Pioneer. We could just play a bunch of effects like that and just go all in trying to make a huge Scourge, or failing that, a big Regisaur, and just Teemer Battle Rage that.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a question of, like, how many levers do you want to tweak? This deck is trying to still be a relatively, like, quote-unquote fair aggro deck. It can still just go 1-drop, 2-drop, 3-drop, you know, buff a 3-drop, get in there. But yeah, you could build the deck in such a way that you're playing, like, 2 Embercleave for the other one, and all you're trying to do is just, like, get that avenue to just, you know, do 14 or whatever out of nowhere. I do think that you need to play... I am sad that I missed it, but yeah, you need to play your Homeless Man, City of Brass, and some number... Maybe 4 is the right number. I would play 3. That's where I'd start. Because, you know, you're not going to see Scourge of the Skyclaves every game, unfortunately. So when it's just damaging you, it's not doing anything else. It literally is just a really bad red-black land.
All right. One other card that flittered across my mind. When you talked about Aether Hub, you know, fueling up your Siphoners and also fixing your mana, how about Wayward Guide Beast, the new Goblin Guide, which will pick up a land whenever it hits them? So if you pick up Aether Hubs, you can potentially get as much energy as you need, whether that's just to play your cards or to power the Siphoner. You can also pick up Ogdoine's Awakening, again, whether just replay that to shock yourself more or because you want to cast it.
I mean, the scenarios you're outlining, it sounds okay, but I mean, I think that's just too bad, especially in a deck with Regisaur where you want your hand to be empty at a certain point. Actually putting lands back in your hand is not even going to do anything. If you have a Regisaur in play.
Yeah, I think you'd have to take out all the 3-drops to make this even.
Oh, yeah. Well, then I definitely don't want to do it. You're talking about replacing Rotting Regisaur and Goblin Rabble Master with this very speculative 1-drop that I can't play on turn 1.
Yeah, and meanwhile, if it's advantageous for you to return a land, your opponent can kill it.
I'm not considering that until somebody 5-0s with it, even as like 4 sideboard cards they never board in. I'm just not going to consider that.
The card is good.
In any format. In any format, you can put it in your deck and beat the shit out of me with it. And then we can have a laugh about how right you are and how wrong I was. But I need to see a human being 5-0 with literally any list. It could be a storm list that never even boards it in, just puts one in the sideboard as a joke. Someone has to do it first.
I sat down today to like sort of think through what are like the best cards from Zendikar for Modern. Like what are my top 8? And where do you think Wayward Guide Beast ended up on that list?
On your list? I don't even want to guess at the level of psychosis that's been gripping you during quarantine.
It has been a long summer. That's true.
Hopefully it wasn't in like the top 20. But it sounds like it was in the top 8.
All right. Well, remains to be seen.
I am not considering that card, but if someone else likes the look of it and wants to put it in a deck that's trying to really get in there with Scourge of the Skyclaves, more power to you.
I think Dan just likes that card to be contrary, is my assessment.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. Moth to a Flame. I just can't resist these cards. Okay, so, I mean, these shells, I can see how they all work. Are there other homes that you, like, considered and were feeling like didn't want to pull the trigger on for Scourge of the Skyclaves?
I mean, the sort of black-white shell you're talking about, I always like to build black-white lists in Pioneer. They never quite get there. You know, Glintsleeve Siphoner is a card you could play in that shell. Again, you can play Aether Hub if you want. I do like the sort of Thoughtseize Glint Sleeve Siphoner as a way to harm ourselves in a way that's like proactive. The like aggro space is just really limited. The mana, you know, is asking serious questions of you. I do think you have to play Thoughtseize. And so you're forced to be, you know, somewhat all in. Your ability to grind is really mitigated because you're going to want a lot of cheap one drops. So you're starting to narrow your requirements, right? You need one drops that can attack. You need to play Thoughtseize. We're starting to fill out our curve. You know, we want other cards that are also aggressive because Scourge of the Skyclaves, if we're looking for doubling effects like Embercleave, I think that encourages you to play other cards that really pay off. You know, Embercleave, it doesn't specifically have to be Rabble Master or Regisaur, but those are cards that come to mind. So I think it's a little bit of a leading path towards some of these choices that I'm making. I'm not sure there's a lot of other variables that can be, you know, knobs that can be tweaked.
What about like a deck that's not aggro, but is more, I don't know, how would you call it? A tempo deck with a high degree of reversibility where you can turn the corner, kind of like traditional Grixis Shadow.
Well, here's one thing that I wonder a little bit. We have a lot to learn about the card, but could you ever play this card out of the sideboard? Like, you know, maybe it's bad against Tron, but it's great against Death Shadow, right?
Oh, I mean,
is that a role that it could play in Modern? I somehow am skeptical, but it's an interesting question to me.
I mean, historically, cards like that that are good in that role but aren't actually like dominant are tend to be bad sideboard cards. You know, sideboard slots in Modern tend to be like game-winning type of bombs, or cards that stop their game-winning types of bombs. This is just like, oh, I'm upgrading whatever random slot into a, like a super efficient two-mana threat. And that's typically, although it could be, but it's not typically been the function of sideboard slots in Modern, where sideboard slots are very valuable.
Although, I mean, I've seen four Tamar Ghosts in the sideboard of combo-ish decks before.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I just wouldn't bring it against Death Shadow specifically. I think it's actually a really bad card against Death Shadow. Just because it's bad against Fatal Push, got a serious Fatal Push problem. I wouldn't do that, but yeah, the sideboard Juke as a Tarmogoyf class creature is interesting. Again, it's like, how do you damage them? So maybe it is like you're saving, David. Maybe you just have to be aggro.
I mean, I just, to have a chance to play it on turn two, you need to attack with a creature. Obviously, you can damage yourself in a variety of ways. You know, some number of Agadeem's Awakening or Blood Crypt and Pioneer in Modern, you know, all the fetches and shocks. But you have to make sure that you're damaging them, and you have to start doing damage to them in a reasonably quick fashion, because on turn three, it's very reasonable that they're going to play Uro. Mm. So if you've only done three damage to them and they play Uro and go up to 20, then Uro's like somehow getting even more value. It's not just a 3-for-1. It's become a 4-for-1 or a 3-for-1 followed by a 0-for-1. So that specifically, I mean, you can't have them at 17, 18 life on turn three. That's just not going to get it done.
Last question then on Scourge. Were you at all tempted by Kalia Zenith Seeker?
I was. I actually brewed up a Kalia deck with the intention of playing four of these, because I was like, wow, finally a cheap demon. You know, the problem with these angels and demons and dragons is that they're generically an expensive creature. They printed Sprite Dragon. It's a very cheap 2-mana dragon. But the mana is already tough for Kalia. Obviously, it's the full Mardu colors. To add the blue was always too hard. This is just a one and a black. It doesn't ask you very much. It's awesome to have a bunch of hits. The problem is that the Kalia deck is fundamentally has to be a mid-range deck, and you don't have cheap ways to attack your opponent. So you start filling out your slots with your, you know, maybe you're playing the one white-white 3-3 angel. You're playing some, you know, a couple of Glory Bringers or whatever, and you put four of these at two. You don't end up with any space at one, because you also have to play interaction and stuff, because you're trying to, you know, draw. You're trying to play a 3-3 angel that draws a card. So, yeah, I actually think I wanted to play it in that deck, and I, like, built up a list, and then the first thing I do is cut those four. You just don't have reliable ways to damage your opponent early in the game.
What if you were doing it actually, like, in Modern with crappy Changelings, Changeling Outcast comes to mind? Even Universal Automaton is a possibility. They're the 1-1 angel from Modern Horizons.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of interesting. The major problem is that a 3-3 flying creature that draws a card, or let's say it even draws two cards when it comes into play, that just isn't that insane. Especially when what you're drawing is 1-mana 1-1 changelings. Like, that's not really worth a card. And the 1-mana 1-1 changeling that you're describing also is weak to literally every removal spell that exists, including certain cards with flashback that are commonly played. So, yeah, I'd never thought about that, but I think the changelings are just weak enough that you're just not getting enough out of your... I mean, you know, modern is just not a good place to play a 3-mana 3/3 that draws a card when they're just going to play Uro.
I mean, you do have most of a party assembled. Kalia is a cleric if you're doing that, so you could get the coveted prize in there, get Winota in there. It's not that far off of being a thing, but I see the problems structurally that you're talking about.
I mean, if you could do that, what you're describing, if you had access to all those cards in Pioneer, that would be worthwhile. Assuming your opponent was also Fetch Shocking, so you could maybe play your Demon on two, but...
Wait, so Dan, you're proposing balancing the Angel, Demon, Dragon subtypes, along with the Party subtypes, along with the Winota human-non-human splits,
yes.
All in the same Masterpiece deck?
Yes.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
Yeah, I mean, so the key thing to do when you have this is to actually just like lay out your deck and just see what happens. Because like I said, I was excited to put this Demon into the Angel deck, and you just start like looking at your curve and looking at your card count, and you want to play 25 lands, and pretty soon you just start running out of space. So you have to decide. I mean, you're going to end up with a lot of 1-mana 1/1 changelings or 2-mana 2/2 changelings.
Yeah, I'm envisioning, like, okay, just off the top of my head, 4 Changing Outcast, 4 Universal Automaton, and 4 of the Archpriest of Iona. That's the cleric 1-drop. On 2, that one is a human. On 2, I want Dark Confidant and Scourge of the Skyclaves. On 3, I want Kalia Zenith Seeker. And then that's like 24 cards. Someone notices some coveted prize. And that leaves me a few slots for your other stuff. So that would be like the basic. That's what you need to have critical mass of all these things. A little bit of humans, a little bit of non-humans. It'd be weird for sure. It might be terrible, but every time you hit a Kalia, that finds you a couple more crappy 1/1s to feel your coveted prize.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Kalia is you need to have about like 17 hits for her to be worth about a card and a third. And I don't think you got to that number even just there. You only listed 12.
Yeah. Well, I have some slots left. So maybe Valiant Changeling, the double strike that can be cast for white.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, you're up to 16. There's no room for Thoughtseize or any creature removal of any kind.
There's no time for that. I mean, we're just...
But the problem is these changelings don't trigger Winota, right? Because they are human.
Correct. Yeah, that's true. Okay, so we have this.
So we have almost no non-humans to attack with okay, Winota, so, and with the cards that she's going to hit are all these 1/1s and 2/2s.
Maybe we don't need Winota. Yeah, there's some work to do.
Yeah,
there's some work to do.
But I like where we're headed here. I think there's like a lot of interesting ideas. But like I said, you have to lay out the deck because then you start to like the Kalia thing. I'm always so excited. And then I like start putting the deck together and like, wow, you really need a lot of these freaking Angel, Demon, Dragon cards and. But the idea of her with changelings is really interesting. I'm kind of intrigued by that. Maybe you only need one Winota if you're going to tutor for her.
That's a better reception than I was expecting, so I'll take it. I'll quit while I'm ahead. All right, it looks like we have once again talked up all our anytime minutes. So Damon, why don't you take us out?
Yeah, it's been a fun time discussing our new best friend in Zendikar, Scourge of the Skyclaves, and all the mailbag questions that we're happy to... Chat, hopefully you like our answers. And if you have any thoughts, feel free to share them with us in Discord or email. And hope everybody has a great time brewing and playing with these new cards from Zendikar.
And with that, we have reached the end of episode 72 of Faith is Brewing. Thanks for hanging out with us. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you are looking for the deck lists we discussed, they are in the episode description. We've got 4 different lists with Scourge of the Skyclave, plus a bonus list featuring Forsaken Monument and Myriad Construct. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/faithisbrewing, where becoming a member at any tier gets you access to our Discord channel, our extended show notes, and other cool rewards. You can send in questions or deck lists for us to review, and you can even get your hands on Faithless Brewing swag. If Patreon's not your thing, you can still help the cast out by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you listen to your pods, and following us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. That's all for this week. As always, stay safe and happy brewing!